Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello and welcome to Underground Nights.
Yes! We're back.
Yes!
Back at last.
I'm joined as ever by the incredibly excited James Mullinger.
I am incredibly excited. This is bizarre. It's bizarre that it's taken us so long to record another one of these. It's been 2 years.
2 years.
We're currently in the middle of, or the beginning of, or the end of, who knows, a global pandemic, a lockdown nationally. You, of course, in the UK, me here in Canada. And in the last couple of weeks, I've done hundreds of podcasts, basically every single kind of interview offer that I've ever had and never had time for. Has suddenly now it's like, yeah, well, it's that, or play with the fucking kids. So, yeah, I'll do it, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But this is the first time that I'm doing one where I'm with my old buddy and I'm talking about something that I'm actually interested in. I'm not having to pretend to be interested in comedy or Canadian politics. I am getting to talk about the only thing that really matters to me, and that is 3 murdered drug dealers from 25 years ago.
Excellent. That's exactly what we're here for, James. The Rettenden murders. Now, you are a little bit obsessed with this. I know you've got every book, you've watched every film. So, for listeners that don't know, give us a quick recap on exactly what happened to who.
6th of December 1995, 3 drug dealers by the name of Pat Tate, Craig Ralph, and Tony Tucker were murdered in a Land Rover on a lane that I believe is called Workhouse Lane in Essex.
Yep.
And I don't know if everyone from our generation remembers where they were when they heard about the Essex Boy murders. I mean, I do, oddly. I was in Maidenhead Library in the town where I grew up, and looking at the newspapers that were there, and it was the front page news, these 3 drug dealers who may or may not have been involved in the supplying of the ecstasy pill that tragically killed schoolgirl Leah Betts. And I was fascinated by it. I mean, this is, as you say, it was 25 years ago, and I was absolutely fascinated by it and have continued to be so, to the extent that here I am 25 years later. I guess for some young males like ourselves, it is our JFK.
Yeah, do you know what? I think you probably hit the nail on the head. For a lot of people, it is, especially if you're involved in that scene at the time, not the selling the drugs part, but out and enjoying yourself part.
That's it.
But more than the Rettenden murders, I definitely remember the Leah Betts death. Yeah. And I remember we had been to a club in Brighton and we were coming home. My friend Tim's driving. It was probably 6:30 in the morning. The sun was coming up and we were driving on the main road out of Brighton back towards Hastings, and there on a massive billboard was a picture of Leah Betts with the intensive care equipment all in her, pipes out of her mouth. and someone had climbed up there and spray painted the words lightweight.
Right. And
did you not know where that was going, did you?
I didn't, and I'm glad we are starting talking about, and again, this wasn't part of the plan, but I'm glad we have started off by talking about this kind of tragic death, because what we're about to do for the next 2 hours is arguably kind of glorify not glorify the people, but glorify the characters that filmmakers have made them become. And that is, of course, a very crucial distinction, that we're obviously not at any kind of stage arguing that Pat Tate, Tony Tucker, Craig Rolfe were pillars of the community.
No.
In any way, shape or form. But however, a whole genre of films, and I will quickly show for people that are watching rather than just listening. This is my part of my collection of books and DVDs relating to, in some capacity, either the Essex Boy Murders or certainly kind of, you know, British hooligans and so forth. And I think that's the fascinating thing with these three guys, is they of course transcended all the issues of the time, in that they were, some of them, or by connection, were somewhat involved in football hooliganism,
yep.
Involved in the supply of ecstasy, and of course, organizing of club nights and raves. And the combination of that, really, the only way they could really make themselves more zeitgeisty is if they started selling pirate videos of video nasties. In that, they were part of this. I think it's what I find fascinating about the era, and I talk about this, been talking about this a lot recently to people, is that, you know, it seems quite old-fashioned now. The video nasty craze, as you know, most people agree now, was utterly absurd. The fact that, you know, people with video shop owners were being demonized and sent to jail for renting out legal copies, you know, or certainly legally released in terms of copyright videos of Texas Chainsaw Massacre, movies that are now considered classics. Then, of course, it seems utterly ludicrous that you know, people were going to jail for organizing raves, which are now, of course, are completely mainstream. And the idea that a group of males meeting in a field to beat shit out of each other being a problem, when we now live in a world where terrorists of all religious denominations mowing cars into people at tourist spots. The idea that it would be considered a problem just for a group of consensual men to beat fuck out of each other now seems quite hilarious, that those three things were the things that were kind of most demonized, and they were supposed to be the kind of end of society as we know it when you and I were kids.
Let's crack on then and talk about one of the first films in the series, which is Rise of the Foot Soldier, number one. I want to tie in because you mentioned about football hooliganism at the time.
Yeah.
Now, this film opens and starts as if it was a football hooliganism movie. It's all about Carlton Leach. You've got the ICF, and it's hooking in that whole football factory audience.
Yes.
Before it goes off on a complete tangent completely different.
It's a very, very strange movie in that respect. And I should point out before we start that this is very quickly in brackets, because we're not going to talk about this movie because it is not part of the canon. But my obsession with these three dead drug dealers was cemented back then, as I say, 25 years ago. But in the year 2000, I was so desperate that when I heard there was a movie called Essex Boys with Sean Bean about what might have happened, which is a very weird way to sell a movie. This might have happened. We've made up a fictional tale. Oddly, the behavior of the characters in that movie are very similar to the behavior of the characters in all of the other movies, in that they are they treat women deplorably, like taking lots of cocaine. Actually, it was more bodybuilding in that than the other movies, to be fair. But I couldn't find anyone to go and see it with me. And when I say I couldn't find anyone, I didn't really know anyone, because I didn't have any friends, because I spent all my time reading about dead drug dealers. So I took the train for 3 hours into London to go to the only cinema this was showing. And it said Leicester Square, but it was that kind of fake Leicester Square, like the Haymarket.
Yeah, I know the bit you mean.
Yeah, where you know you're off to see a shit movie. When it's actually, it's where we had the premiere for Comedians Guide to Survival, actually. But you know, and it was like the screen wasn't much bigger than my laptop. Anyway, that's how obsessed I was from a very young age. So between that and then, there were, I think, other movies about it. My chronological, but you're right.
Have a list here if you want them. You've got Essex Boys, that's the one with Sean Bean. Then you've got Rise of the Foot Soldier.
Right, so Foot Soldier was first. Okay, so we are in order. So you're obviously right. Foot Soldier, it was promoted as, and definitely starts as, a movie for, as you rightly said, the Football Factory crowd. So the Football Factory, again, is a movie that I adore. I believe it is one of the greats. Here is my Football Factory DVD signed by Mr. D. Dyer.
You bastard.
And obviously, I am a big fan of the work of Hooligans. This has been covered at length before. And by the work of Hooligans, I mean having a good time and not hurting anyone else that hasn't agreed to be hurt. However, that is maybe a debatable point. Foot Soldier, I went to see this with a friend of mine, Paul Wilson, who you've met. We went to see this and I was very excited because, again, I love Football Factory. Here's another Hooligan movie. It's very down and dirty, isn't it?
Yeah, because you've got that opening where it kind of teases you in about it being about the ICF.
Yeah.
You've got the story of Carlton Leach.
Yeah.
And how he progresses from football to working on the Doors.
Yeah.
With our three main protagonists.
Yes. The debate as to whether these films glamorize hooliganism has of course been out there. I would argue none of them do particularly, unless you're into it, in which case, yes, you're going to be attracted by violence. As someone like myself who is scared of violence and scared of getting a paper cut, I wouldn't say they glamorized it, but that sequence on the tube train is insane. I mean, I remember seeing this and I'm watching it, and funny enough, I've sat and made my wife watch that sequence a couple of weeks ago. And of course,
did you notice they're all wearing PPE?
Are they?
All the Millwall fans, yeah. They're literally wearing hospital like hats and hospital masks.
Why?
I don't know.
Is that a thing?
Well, I don't know. It only came to my attention, obviously, because over here we haven't got any PPE. Yeah, and we were joking. Right. Now we know where it all is.
That's one thing the Hooligans did wrong. They stole all the PPE. But the interesting thing about the movie is that, very down and dirty, very gritty. Doesn't seem to be trying to glamorise it.
No.
The tube train sequence is horrifying. The odd thing is, obviously, again, it's odd how... you're never sure with these movies if you're supposed to like these protagonists or not.
I don't know. I mean, because I think you're kind of doing this because they're very clever. They switch from that hooliganism. It almost becomes like human traffic for the next section because it's all about clubbing.
Yes.
You've got these big club tunes, and that's when Ricky Harnett, he is and portrays a cunt. He looks like a cunt. He comes across as a cunt. And there's no... he absolutely nails that role. You're right. Genuinely scared of him when he's talking, what he's saying, what he's about. He's so convincing. But when he becomes involved in the whole club scene and he's talking about working on the Doors and stuff, I'll catch you noncing in the toilets, I'll stick a glass in your ass. His mate's talking about his club. It's a den of cunts. And it changes tone to this like almost comical ravey, taking drugs film.
Yeah, when he takes the pill and he's like, I'm not feeling anything. Yeah. Like, I love you, right? And,
the thing in that scene is his mate's face tells you everything.
Yeah, it is. And you know where it's going, but it's still funny when it happens. And Ricky Harnett is an incredibly good actor.
Yeah.
Embodies that role perfectly. I don't understand why he isn't doing more and hasn't done more. I feel like that the performance in this is great. So it also shifts then into, so it's gone from like hooligans to drugs. It then goes into
the whole thing about the Turks.
The Turks.
And then it becomes a proper nasty gangster film.
Yeah. Now that segment, clearly the Turkish bit could have completely been removed. You know, if the plan was to always go from hooliganism into drugs, into Tucker Tate Roth, the Turkish bit serves no purpose other than to basically convey the message that being a guard for drug dealers has clearly a lot of downsides, i.e. seemingly, and also there's no resolution to it, which I guess is just based on the true story, which is that they never actually find out who did it. You expect during the torture scene that it's going to come out which one, that one of them did it. And then it ends with that very, very depressing thing, which I get, again, is, I guess, based on truth, where his friend, having been tortured, kills himself.
Yep, absolutely. It's now, so dark. It just takes that massive turn into the world of the gangsters, becomes really, really dark with the torture.
That's the torture bit.
It's such a massive, it's almost like watching a Korean film where you have all these crazy tonal shifts.
Totally.
And it works really well.
It does work well. And this is the odd thing, that it's... And that's a very good example of Korean films. Like, definitely in other countries, they don't have a problem with these tonal shifts. Here, whenever that happens, critics will kind of complain that it flits all over the place. It doesn't know what it wants to be. And it's like, why does it have to be one thing? I found it odd because at the beginning, I've read a couple of Carlton Leitch's books. And again, you know, seemingly he's kind of left that path behind. Now trying to be a good guy. Who knows? I don't know him personally. Seems like a good guy. But oddly, in this movie, which is about him, and again, they've gone to the effort of making a biopic of the guy. So clearly he must have some redeeming features. But at some point in the film, and I can't remember how far in it is, they show us that our lead character has basically nailed someone to the floor. Which again, I mean, I'm not in the torture game. But...
No.
I have to say that seems quite extreme. Generally, I guess in these kind of movies, what you can do is you can make someone likable or relatable by them doing what they have to do within their world. But I would argue that nailing someone to a floor, not entirely necessary.
But then we get the kind of the final tonal shift into comedy.
Yes, yes.
Tony... Ralph are effectively fucking idiots, violent idiots, but idiots nonetheless. And you've got things. My favourite line in the film is Pat Tate. He goes, "Had to service the old woman, give her an oil change."
The lines that are given to those guys to deliver are just magnificent. And I mean, there's so many. And of course, I mean, the incredibly varied uses of the C word. I think the phrase shit cunt is used in all four movies. Yep. And again, I don't hear that phrase often. But there it is in the movie.
Well, just so you know, you do know that rewatching each of the four films, I kept track of how many times they said cunt in each film. And we're going to have a little quiz later. You can have a guess. Mate, it was a labour of love. That you don't get that beautiful kind of forensic analysis from Mark Kermode.
You do not. And that is why I always come to Paul Phil for everything I need to know.
That's another little, obviously, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Absolutely. Genius. And I salute you for that. And when you told me that might be happening, I cannot deny being ridiculously excited.
Can I just say, there is one other like really weird thing that comes out of nowhere. You're in the middle of the comedy section, and then Roland Manoukian, who plays Craig Rolfe, he basically murders someone.
Yes.
Gives him an overdose, drives him out and just dumps his body.
Yes.
That's pretty dark.
It's absolutely horrendous. It's a horrible sequence. It did happen, by the way.
Yes. This afternoon, I was watching Dispatches from 1996.
Right. I mean, this is how mental are we?
Worryingly, not only did that, someone, I was thinking, I wonder if anyone's put any of this material online. Guess what? Of course they have, all of it. They even have the Crime Watch episode.
Did you find the autopsy photos? Because I don't know if they're still out there. But...
I'm not into what... Look, James...
Neither am I.
That's your... But, you know...
No, I know. But Bernard O'Mahony's website seems to be down. But he had a website with chat rooms in it that was... I mean, again, I haven't been on there for a few years, so I don't know when it went down. But all I know is that basically during my 14 years at GQ, I spent 8 hours a day in the chat rooms on his website, just full of people's theories. It's like, nah, mate, Noy done it. But in there was the autopsy pictures. But yeah, you're right, it is all online. And yes, they did do that. I actually didn't realise it was just, I can't remember if it was just Rolf in real life, if it was all.
Well, in the kind of recreations and the Dispatches episode, they implicated all of them. But in the film, it's just Rolf.
It's just him, and it clearly pegs them for what they are, which was complete monsters, which, of course, as we're going to get to, they are not quite so monstrously depicted in the later films.
No. But, well, let's go. Should we move on to number two? Right, let me fling my page of it.
Now, what I find fascinating about all these movies is the shifts in actors moving around and one person directing. So the second one is, of course, written and directed by Ricky Harnett himself, produced by our good friend Jonathan Sothcott, also produced by Carlton Leach, which, again, seems odd because this is a film... not an overly flattering depiction.
I think for this film, there was some, from what I've read, there was some legal issues. I think they tried to put it out as something slightly different, but the Foot Soldier franchise claimed copyright. Is that what happened?
Right. You know what? I can't recall, but I do remember now, actually, that Reign of the General was actually possibly the original title. And again, I also don't want to, I can't even remember anything I was told back then. But yes, maybe that's the case, that they came in and of course, there's Stephen Berkoff in it. But Ricky Harnett, Andrew Loveday is the producer, who, of course, appears in later films, 3 and 4, and also directed 4. So it's just interesting, this kind of, I mean, at some point, if this pandemic continues, this war will become a family tree of all the different people moving around. I mean, for example, I guess another, the most obvious one is that Kirsten Waring plays Pat Tate's wife in Rise of the Foot Soldier and Bonded by Blood. So it's the same.
I was going to have a little section on the poor women in this franchise later.
Yes,
it won't take long.
Yeah, I mean it is awful, and I would say it's if I have one complaint, and maybe it's the right thing that they do, which is put these horrible scenes in, where these extended scenes where these guys who have been somewhat built up to have some redeeming qualities suddenly beat their wives, call them the C word because the wives had the audacity to do something like offer them a blowjob, and these sequences are very disturbing, and I kind of watch these and think, well, why is this here? Is this Purian? Is it here because it, I mean, horrifically, are these scenes in there because the fan base of these films want to see them, or is it actually just to remind us, stop admiring these guys? They're actually
I think it is, because they wouldn't have violence against women in there for any other reason than as an occasional prod as to who they are.
Yeah. So this again is a whole different kettle of fish, because of course Tucker Tate Rolf are only in it as flashbacks. Another interesting staple of these films is the character who can get over the death of anyone at the drop of a hat, but if it suits the narrative, can't get over the murder of this person. Perfect example. I mean, the best example of this is Kidulthood to Brotherhood, when Sam in Brotherhood is, of course, targeted by this guy who is willing to die for his nephew and just goes after Sam for this whole movie. Wants willing to die for him. At the end, wants to die because he loves his nephew. But in the first movie, when his nephew died, I mean, he was giving the kid heroin. He was giving him a gun, telling him to go out and do, like. Similarly with this, Carlton Leach cannot get over the death of his buddy Tony Tucker.
He cannot get over it.
Now, he barely knew the guy 5 minutes.
No.
And in the previous movie, his best mate killed himself having been tortured by Turkish drug dealers. And 5 seconds later, he's forgotten. So, but again, that's just a sweet staple of these movies.
Well, it's a classic one, isn't it? It's the spiral into misery, the falling apart and the redemption. This is kind of soundtracked by him hoovering up mountains and mountains of Chang.
Mountains.
Mountains. The soundtrack as well in this, I notice, it switches from the kind of rave stuff into a much more drum and bass.
Yes, lots of drum and bass.
Terry Turbo. That's more of his.
Yes, right. It is. And
did he do the music?
I was just looking to see. Actually, no. I mean, so clearly none of them were involved. And again, who knows why? It would be interesting. Well, Sothcott had an idea for me the other day, which I think this is possibly the start of this. If two idiots can write a book about the films of Danny Dyer, another two idiots can write a book about the Essex Boy movies, because there is a demand for it. I mean, I know there's a demand because I have another 1,000 books over there of books written by 10 books by Freddie Foreman, 10 books by Eddie Richardson. And they fill bookstores in England because idiots like me buy them. Where's the footage? What is interesting about it is what went on behind the scenes, who knows? It's a solid movie. Ricky yep. Harnett, who has presumably not directed a Biscuit movie before. It looks great. It sounds great. The cinematography, and what's weird about these movies is they're, of course, I guess, produced on a comparatively what they would call low budget. However, none of them look like truly low budget.
It's not like Mob Andy, but this is more like this is more of a kitchen sink drama almost with sporadic violence. You know, there's a bit where he gets his creme brulee burner out on a nonce's knackers. I mean,
I mean, it's dark. It also brings in one of the Carlton Leach books that I read that I enjoyed was about his a son coming out of the woodwork and all the rest of it, and all this kind of stuff is brought in there. The nature of fatherhood. There was a very negative, unsurprisingly negative review in The Guardian for Rise of the Foot Soldier 2.
I'm shocked, James.
I know, hard to believe. However, the comments underneath I found fascinating because they are, and it's not people going, "Oh, you slag, you nonce, you know, don't diss my." Someone's actually commented, "They're surprised by this review. Having seen the film, I think it takes the Essex gangster genre in a new direction. Director Harnett avoids all the tired faces that crop up in all these films." So, and one of the things the Guardian critic said was that it was full of ropey performances. And so this commented person has said, who gave these ropey performances? Was it Luke Mabley, who acted everyone off the stage in the West End production of Festin and here plays torturer Sean with deadpan control? And he is magnificent. And when actually Sothcott showed me an early cut of this before it came out, and that was the thing that stood out to me, was that guy just elevates this. And Jasper Britton, the Royal Shakespeare Company star, who gives his gangland boss a subtle touch of theatricality far more disturbing than the usual gurning we're used to seeing. This genre might not be to everyone's taste, but surely give this one deserves credit for coming up with something that doesn't insult the audience's intelligence. And this is the thing, and you and I have talked to death about this before, but it's just the British crime film cannot get a fair shot by critics, no matter what they do. And when one of the questions that always gets asked in every single Guardian review, every single time a new movie comes out, every single time, it says the same thing. It says, who's buying this? Who is this for? Who are they making this for? And it's like, well, A, millions of people because they make money. B, us. So answer to your question, Guardian, it's us. Now, is it to everyone's taste? No. But I mean, neither, you know, 4-hour documentaries on paint drying are not to my taste. But Peter Bradshaw loves them. But I'm not asking who it's for because I know who it's for, Bradshaw.
No, I mean, this is a really well-made film. It is very dark. It is almost quite serious in a way. I think one of the issues it suffered from was that, again, the tonal shift, people expecting to maybe see the three idiots again larking about, and they haven't. They've got this kind of heart on your sleeve story. Ricky Harnett's acting his heart out, bless him, and he's done a great job.
Yeah,
but I don't think it quite met people's expectations. If this had been a standalone film with those performances, I think it would have done even better.
I
agree. What I'm saying? Because people came into this with expectations and baggage from the first one.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And it's weird because you've got this four-part series, and I actually just discovered today, and I'm sure we'll get to this later, but that the fifth Foot Soldier movie is actually going to be a reboot.
And
I'm guessing when they say a reboot, they're going to be rebooting it, but with the same actors. There's no way.
Has anyone done that before?
I don't know. I don't know how you can call it a reboot. I'm curious. The only way I can take this is that they are going to retell the story of Tucker Tate Roth, but maybe with the newly found comedic tone.
Well, should we let's address that. Let's go on. I'm going to turn my page over.
Oh, I had one more thing to say about...
Okay, yeah, of course.
Foot Soldier 2. Again, I mean, one of the comments that people always comment on these things, whenever there's a new British gangster film and they've got, like, it's full of great actors, but someone would always comment something like, "What, no Danny Dyer?" And this one says, "What, no Frank Harper? Are you mugging me off?" And it's like, well, Christopher Nolan uses all the same actors, right? And Michael Caine says it's great because it's like Nolan has his own little rep company, right? Now, why is it that for posh, Eton-educated actors all doing the same? I mean, The fucking Marvel Avengers franchise, the same actors playing the same characters over and over again in basically identical movies. Well, I'm sorry, take your fucking Avengers Assemble, because there's only one Avengers Assemble for me, and it is fucking Foot Soldier 3.
Yes.
Go
on.
Oh, yeah, so Empire gave Foot Soldier 2 a two-star review, and actually said that Hartnett shows some promise as a director. Stephen Berkoff, Mikago singing villain, prove he's not scared of doing the left field. But part two, setting itself up for Godfather style part three, takes itself far too seriously, and it's for diehard fans only. And it's interesting that Empire back then were already acknowledging in 2015 that there are fans of hooligan genre movies. But I found it interesting that they say setting itself up for Godfather part three, and yet I don't think any of us could have in a million years predicted this.
Because it's just fucking brilliant.
It's absolutely
let's rewind this right. So Rise of the Foot Soldier 3 is : the Pat Tate story.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The Pat Tate story. So let's just start with that. So first of all, I want to hear about your first time watching it. But I'm just going to start with the obvious factor, which it has been pointed out, and it's not clever or interesting, and it doesn't matter one iota. But the fact is that a decade after playing some murdered drug dealers, they are playing those same murdered drug dealers 10 years prior to that.
Yep.
And let's just say they don't look 10 years younger. And never is it more apparent than in the scenes when they flash back to... And they've been very careful not to show much of them because they...
Absolutely.
But the important thing is it doesn't matter. So when you first saw this, what did you think? And how did that...
The thing that sums this film up, the thing that's burnt into my mind is one prostitute, two prostitutes, three prostitutes, four prostitutes, five prostitutes.
I can't do five prostitutes, Pat. I'm not talking about me, you can't. What I'm going to do. Now take a pill and get lively. And that scene, I read Craig Fairbrass do a tweet about this, that scene... I mean, as is often the case, I'm sure, with filmmaking, they were running out of light, and him and Joss Myers, who plays... what is Joss Myers' character's name? It's interesting because he... I don't know if he's based on anyone real or if he is just added for convenience. His name is... So Jimmy J is a real person, and he pops up in certainly the first, second, and obviously the third film. The first, third, and fourth. But Joss Myers' character, I'm not sure if he's actually based on someone real. Anyway... That scene was kind of bashed out, and it's just brilliant. And the first 25 minutes of the movie, if not the whole movie, is just full of insanely quotable lines. They are delivered by Craig, Terry, And what's the name of the guy that plays Craig Roth? Roland. So that with such flourish that they know how great this script is. I don't know how much was improvised, but you're right. That line, that scene. I remember when it started, and I'm kind of like, right, okay. So this is. I like the foot soldier movies. I like the business. Yep. So this is going to be a kind of interesting kind of combo of that. And in some ways, it does play with
It starts out in Marbella.
That's at Marbella. And it's interesting that the fourth one is, of course, called Rise of the Foot Soldier Marbella, when the third one also could be called Rise of the Foot Soldier Marbella, because it's... Because
it's all about a drug deal that goes tits, basically. That's the main thrust of it. Cause start in Marbella, they're back to Southend, then they're back to Marbella, then Gibraltar, then they're really clever... Do you know what? I think it's only like 90 minutes or not much longer than that. But they pack so much into it. It blows my mind.
So much in. It is ridiculous. And of course, the Marbella thing, Pat going to Marbella is referenced in the first Foot Soldier as well. Oh, sorry, not Marbella. Him going to Gibraltar and being arrested there. But I remember I was back in England again. I mean, as you know, I mean, part of what I love so much about all of these movies and all of this, you know, British crime stuff and all these movies is it's my kind of taste of home. Like while I'm here in Canada, you know, I there's not much I miss about England. I miss friends like your good self, but I don't miss much else. But this is my taste of home. So when I was back in England for Christmas, the year that this came out, 2017, and it, of course, I believe came out on Boxing Day. During that Christmas period, every single house I went to that I stayed at, I took as a thank you gift for the host, like bottle of wine, copy of Foot Soldier, even for people that I knew would hate it, and pretty much made of all. So in that first week alone, I watched it about 10 times. It's
should we just give the listeners a little overview? So it's basically they're trying to buy a load of pills in Spain to bring back to Southend. They end up.
That's yes, exactly. Which is odd because I was about to correct you there, but oddly that's the exact same plot of Four, which isn't it?
Yeah,
because
it is.
I was saying that the trailer for the fourth one is brilliant because it's literally like it's like. Essex has run out of pills. We gotta go to Marbella, and it's like as if Essex has run out of pills. And they say they've run out of pills, but then a minute later, Tony Tucker spikes Pat Tate with a pill. So anyway, but you're right. They go to Marbella to score pills. You're right.
The local bigwig. He tries to iron Pat out. His mates have that amazing fight scene in the hotel corridor.
Yes, which is just.
Brutal fire extinguisher in the head.
Absolutely, and the fire extinguisher. You know that line. This is how we do things in Essex. It's. I mean, again, I think the change of pace and the change of tone into this kind of slightly comedic and clearly, you know, I mean, how many shots do you need to see of men hoovering up lines of coke? Well, frankly, all of them, because
in this, it's just relentless.
It's just nonstop. It's relentless, and in this context, I do find it funny. I you know, again, people say how many times you need to see that same thing over and over again. It's like, well, how many times do you need to see Kate Hudson kiss someone in a rom-com? I mean, you know, this is what the genre is. In the first 10 minutes, I mean, I think are the best first 10 minutes of any movie. In that, like, causing egg dealt with lively. That's what it's all about, right? And then there's the weird bit of humour when 10 minutes in, they go to that house and there's those two gay guys in there, right?
Yeah.
And this is the first real shift in tone, which is somewhat, you know, it's a somewhat dated homophobic joke.
Yep.
However, the Pat Tate and Tony Tucker that we've been grown to know in these other movies would have probably done an even more deplorable thing and possibly... indulged in a homophobic attack on these guys. Instead, once they realize they're gay, it's more of a kind of a 1970s, oh no, sorry, no, we don't, you know. And then the gay guys say, well, you might want to stick around in a very kind of camp voice.
Deliberate, almost kind of redefining of their characters from utter bastards into kind of lovable comedy characters. And they transition them over the course of those two films. By the time you're into the third act of number four, you're literally just rolling around laughing.
It's a full-on comedy movie,
yeah.
Especially Tucker and Rolf in a camper van. It is Carry On Foot Soldier.
Yeah.
And frankly, it is all the best for it. What I love so much about Foot Soldier 3 is it's one of the most watchable films I've seen it so many times. You are right that they pack a lot in, but
yep.
It's very... I've watched it now probably 30 or 40 times. I couldn't... I mean, you did a very good job this then. Besides this, I couldn't really tell you what it's about. Another line that I found absolutely hilarious was, you do not sell drugs in this club because we fucking do. But that's hilarious, right? That I also love this. There's a bit when he... I think it's the same scene. He beats the shit out of someone. Tate beats the shit out of someone. And then he turns to his group and he's like, right, take his money, take his drugs, beat the fuck out of him, and I'll see you at the bar, booze. Right? And I just love the removal of letters there, because it's the kind of thing that you and I would do. But I'll see you at the bar, booze. Right?
Yeah.
It's not, I'll see you at the bar for some booze, or let's have a booze up. It's, I'll see you at the bar, booze. I just love that. And one thing I've actually not touched upon yet is just that... And if case it isn't already obvious, Fairbrass' performance is magnetic. I mean, and I don't mean this in a, like, this is, it's good for a British film. Like, I think he embodies this character in the same way that Robert De Niro embodies Jimmy the Gent in Goodfellas.
Yep, it's just phenomenal. I mean, there's some brilliant set pieces. The big fight with the Pikeys, the whole yes. prison scene with Sean Ryder. Fucking
so violent.
I mean, the crucifixion, the stuff about his missus having an affair, all this is packed in and into such a like short runtime. It's incredible.
I could not agree more. I mean, again, there's the gypsy, there's Jimmy J, there's Harris. Craig Rolf's hair changes lengths all the time, which is the plotting makes no sense. It starts in my bed, goes back to it. It flits all over the place. Each scene is like a scene from a different movie. Of course, Jamie Foreman, son of Freddie Foreman's in it.
Jamie Foreman, and he's really good in it.
Yeah, he is. I mean, the combination of it's kind of like when you're a kid and it's your birthday party and someone puts out, like, there's like a big like meat feast pizza, and then someone throws like ice cream on it and hundreds of thousands, and then they throw all this stuff on it and candy and crisps, and you go, oh my god, that looks disgusting, and too much going on, and you bite into it and you go, that's the tastiest fucking thing I've ever had. That is Foot Soldier 3.
To quote you back from something you said about it, it is the Jive Bunny mega mix of hoolie porn.
That's exactly it.
All of your favourite.
That's exactly it. Like, you can tell, like, there's the ones that are in some way connected in some ways to hooligans, right? Yeah. But then I can take you over to this. This is my gangster book collection. That's branching out into great train robberies and northern drug dealers and Scottish drug dealers. Again, less interested in them. I'm not so much interested unless they're from Essex. And then over here, it's just other gangster movies. And then, of course, other gangster movies. And then, of course, when you sit here, which is in my use, this is where I sit to watch the movies. I just sit here, and then this is all the trauma videos right next to me. And I have classy movies. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I've got three on a meat hook, right?
Right.
You can see that?
I've got three. Oh, lovely, yes.
I've got Torso. I've got 6-7 different versions of I Spit on Your Grave. But ultimately, right, see, what I'm trying to illustrate is that I've got the classics, right? I've got...
James.
I know how to have fun. I can focus. Play games like... I can play games like Shark Attack. I'm going to focus. The point is this. But I've been so excited about doing this specific podcast.
It's only because I'm looking at the runtime.
Larry Lamb is, of course, in it. I don't know why Larry Lamb doesn't come back. And we're going to talk about the Larry Lamb in the fourth one. Sean Ryder is exceptionally good in this. And on the extras on this, there is a wonderful scene where they talk about Sean Ryder coming to the set and how it was very nerve-wracking for him because not being an actor and being obviously that surrounded with extras. But he nails his scene. His death, again, these special effects. Why does he need to be bottled 50 times by a light fitting and then have his back broken on a bench? But why not? Because when you're throwing that much stuff at a movie, and who's the director? Zachary Adler. The screenplay is by Michael Loveday. who maybe is possibly a brother of Andrew Loveday.
Mate, I think people who listen to this podcast gave up years ago worrying about us reading out the name of the director.
Yes.
They want to know how many times they said cunt.
Yeah, they do. And that's right. We need to get to that.
We're going to touch upon Rise of the Foot Soldier 4.
But yes, we are. But how did... I'm mortified because I don't have... And if anyone's watching this, from Signature Entertainment, who also, by the way, released Comedian's Guide to Survivor, I don't have the DVD of Foot Soldier 4 because it didn't come out. It was on demand when I was over in England over Christmas, which meant that every single house I turned up at, I had to turn up with a bottle of wine and then pay $10 for fucking pay-per-view in everyone's house. So I spent about $200 on Foot Soldier 4, and Amazon UK won't send it to me. I don't know why. There's certain rights issues with certain things. This I was able to get, which again, I mean, you were bang on. I'm glad you told me it was kitchen sink and not...
It's not what you're thinking, is it? Right.
No,
James, it's amazing. Focus.
So Foot Soldier 4.
Back in Marbella. Well, you think he's going to iron out Larry Lamb, and he doesn't, because I love the way that they still made the effort for him to go to the location where he was, and he's not there.
And he's not there.
What's the point? They could have just announced he was dead.
Yes.
What a waste of everyone's time, money and resources.
Utterly insane. And the scene itself isn't great either.
No, it's not funny either, is it?
It's not very funny. I mean, literally, like, mistaken identities can be funny, but mistaken identity's got to be like Fairbrass climbs into bed and thinks he's going to fuck the bird, but accidentally puts his dick in Larry Lamb. That's a funny mistaken identity. But this, it's literally walking in there. And again, the Fairbrass, I can't tell the difference between the characters and the actors.
It's Frank Harris that Larry Lamb plays.
Right. Pat Tate would not just apologise and walk away.
That's what's weird about it. That's the continuation of that gentle sort of softening of their characters, though.
It is. So you basically, in the third one, you've got them, being again, slightly kind of Neanderthal homophobic, but not being violent towards these guys for being gay and being apologetic. And again, here we are again. He's apologised for getting there. I mean, you would generally do a bit of research to find out if someone actually lived somewhere before turning off. But also, the other thing is, I don't know about you, I'd forgotten about Larry Lamb as a character, so I didn't need him to be referenced as being moved out. Anyway, 4. So when I saw 4, the first, and I don't have the Blu-ray, and I hope someone's going to send it to me. When I watched it the first 5 times over Christmas, I have to say, I wasn't in love with it. Because the trailer was so amazing. The third one is so good. The third one, as I say, just the beginning, just bang, bang, bang. The fourth one starts oddly slow. I think some of the plotting at the beginning is a bit off. Given what we're expecting from a Foot Soldier movie, I feel like it starts a tiny bit slow. But when Pat Tate bangs through those club doors and walks into the club, and Rolf and Tucker are out the back torturing that guy, that door opening... When Fairbrass bangs that door open and you see him there and the lights and everything, a beautiful piece of filmmaking. And I get goosebumps and spine tingles, and I just get this excitement. I'm like, yes! Like, Pat Tate's in the house. Which, again, I mean, going back to the reality
of... spikes him, isn't it? Because he says to Pat Tate, you're the only person who takes an E and still wants to kill people.
Still wants to kill people, yeah. And again, it's one of those things where... One minute he's worried about the lack of drugs. Then now it's like, and understandably, if that guy's got him sent down, he's going to want to kill him. It's all over the place, of course. The Tucker and Rolf road trip is hilarious and brilliant.
I mean, that's the best thing about that film. Them two dicking about.
I could
give me 90 minutes of those two
Pratting
about.
I could not agree more. I could watch, I mean, and the combination of the three of them, where like Pat Tate, they're like the two stooges. Mm-hmm. And then you've got him, who's also funny in his own right, but never anything other than angry and just wanting to wank or do blow. So anyway, I guess I didn't like it the first time I watched it, but then I watched it sober and absolutely loved it. And I've watched it 3 or 4 times sober since. And it's a blinder. Essex has run out of pills. What a brilliant plot line. Of course, I mean, the twist at the ending. Well, again, there's a couple of things that don't sit right. One is, and this is just me nitpicking.
Go on.
When Rolf and Tucker are in Amsterdam, they insult those domestic birds by asking if they're brasses.
Yeah.
And then the girls spot the money.
Yeah, and they do a big visual tell on it as well.
Big visual tell on it, right? She points at it, right? Now, we're led to believe that the girls then are going to steal the money, of course, which would kind of make sense. And maybe at some point in the script they were going to, who knows, when they introduce that other character later. But it seems very odd that these girls then decide to just party with them and then shag them and then don't try and steal the money.
No, they could have just taken that, because literally taking that tell out, it's literally the camera panning to the money would have taken, what, 2 seconds? And that removed that completely, because I was the same. Because it isn't nicked by them, it's nicked by someone else in a little while. And they show you him counting it.
Yeah, that's it. Like, it's such a weird thing. And maybe they're trying to give us a reason as to why those two birds would want to shag these two geezers. But then they don't need to.
I like
to do
the way
that,
we've descended into calling women birds already.
I know. I never do this, but it's because I know. And I apologise to anyone listening that didn't know this side of me, that I'm obsessed with these. With three dead drug dealers.
Jay, to this degree of feminism, calling women birds.
Birds. So that's one that doesn't sit well.
I mean, Jay, to be honest with you, the whole thing, him telling those two idiots to bring 20 large over so he can buy some pills, where he knows he's already going to rob him anyway, but the other guy's going to rob him as well.
I know.
Again, it's just a mishmash, but do you know what? It just about hangs together, and I was loving it. And then Nick Naverne turns up, and you're like, yes!
Yes, and he is directing the reboot.
Ah.
Yes, he knows the genre inside out. Again, yep. I mean, he has been in lots of the great ones. He's even shared a scene in Vendetta with one of the finest actors ever to come out of Surrey boarding school.
Oh, God.
I know. but he knows the genre, A, from being in tons of them.
Wait, can we get to be extras on this one, James?
Yes, I that's a very good point. This is again one of Southcott's, which is one I thoroughly enjoy. Nick Naverne, a hooligan first, cop second. But he, of course, also directed, which I'm sure you're obviously well aware of.
I think GBH is the only Southcott film I don't have.
It's a good one. It came out after...
Oh, I've got that. Right, I can see what's coming in. Of course, he knows the genre. If you know the genre well enough to kind of pastiche it and take the mickey out of it, you can do it justice when you're doing it for real.
And interestingly, this movie, the genius of it, is it functions as a hooligan movie and a spoof. And that is the definition of it. That's a very difficult thing to do.
Yeah, for sure.
I just don't know why this was tucked between the things. It's a picture of my youngest son
reading a book about the craze.
Reading a book, yeah. Not just...
So Nick, if you're listening, can me and James come and be... Preferably if you're doing a scene in Marbella.
Yeah, please, Nick. I mean, literally, talk about a dream. Well, to be honest, I believe the way the film is funded, you know how there's certain scenes when they go into a club?
So if we chuck them a few quid, we can stand at the bar.
You can pay. So basically, towards the beginning, when they're in the club, and he's like, there's no gear in here, we've run out of pills. And then there's a shot of a very long shot of a guy like doing a bit of cocaine, and you think, well, why have they shown that? It's not necessary. We've been told there isn't any, but it's there because they do this. Part of the way it's financed is people pay.
They crowdfunded it,
and which is why at the end the list of supporting artists in the credits are all named, because I guess they pay. But I mean, you know what? I don't buy, other than DVDs and books. My wife buys all kinds of other things. I don't really buy anything other than wine and sound equipment for my computer. I mean, I think I should be allowed to spend some of my hard-earned money on us being extras in Foot Soldier the Reboot. there's literally nothing else in life that I really want to do but to be in one of these movies. Okay, so the end, of course, another ridiculous contrivance, but also...
Yes.
Slightly funny, like, oh my God, Josh's character says, Pat, the pills are bad. You got to get rid of them. Now, of course, the movie is structured now in a way that we're kind of on side. Like, oh no. Now, don't forget, they've also stolen a shed load of cash from Nick Naverne's safe. So it's not like the pills were were everything. It wasn't a heist movie. It's kind of like an Italian Job ending, except the goal is somewhere else, and it's just a few ecstasy pills. That would be a good Italian Job, with just a bag of pills at the end of the... Anyway, he's on the beach. He thinks the pills are bad, and he says, you know, oh my God, we've got to get rid of them, because I was going to get done for murder.
This is all ties into Leia Bett, so even though they don't name her...
It does. A very distastefully joke, if that... And you're right, it's impossible.
Mate, we opened with a Leia Bett's joke, sorry.
No, we did. But what I mean is it's quite distasteful script writing because this is the end. This is the fourth part of a franchise that has kind of made heroes of these four deplorable people. It seems slightly wrong to reference it, and that's what I thought, but maybe they're not referencing it.
They're not referencing it directly, but you know.
And when you're watching it, you can't help think about it. What's absurd about it is that Pat Tate, who we've just watched fucking glassing people and slicing and dicing for the last 2 hours, doesn't seem that fussed about being a murderer. Right, or being caught for being one. I also don't think that he'd be the kind of person to be saying, let's flush the pills. He'd be the one going, fuck it.
Also, they would hide them and come back to them, wouldn't they? There's no way they'd
exactly.
be throwing them in
yeah,
the
they'd
sea.
Yeah, they'd be flushing them. It's a comedic ending to a brilliant film.
Very quickly, I just want to touch upon, and this covers all of the genres, the women in this. We said we'd come back to it.
Yeah.
Of the female characters in it, it's only really in three and then more in four that any of them have any lifting to do. And that's... Emily Wyatt, who plays Charlotte in 3 and 4.
Yes. Very good.
She gets some great lines. And have you noticed they get her to say cunt quite a lot?
Yes, a lot. And she's really good. The character's also quite believable. Yep. I love the bit when she's sat there, she's doing lines, and then he comes out and he goes, what are you doing? It's fucking... This is one funny thing about...
It's like 11 o'clock in the morning. It's
like 9 in the morning and she goes, you're boring me. that's beautiful.
It's almost like the female Pat Tate, isn't she?
Yeah, very much so.
She's on the chat the whole time.
The whole time. The bit towards the end when they obviously rip her off, feels slightly mean-spirited, and even more so when Rolf opens the door and says, come on then.
I know. And you knew that. He is such a cunt, isn't he?
I know, he's such an evil bastard. Which we knew, because he obviously murdered someone in the first movie. However... The one thing that has to be said is, and then Carlton's wife in 1 and 2, again, great. She actually has some things to do. She's a great actress. Kirsten Waring, of course, plays Tate's wife, both when Tate is played by Fairbrice and when it's played by Tamar Sand. And in both times,
but they did spend a lot of time on the back foot, whereas Emily White is the only one who ever gets to spend any time on the front foot.
That's true. And thankfully, part of the shift into these films being enjoyable is there isn't an unnecessary violence against women in them.
No, which there's not
in
anymore,
the other
is
ones. No. And again, I mean, I remember when the first one came out, one of the things that horrified me in the Sean Bean one was, again, the treatment of Alex Kingston in that. I mean, that is obviously the reality of how these people did and do behave. But they are, I mean, they're blokey movies, and ultimately no one comes off well. Out of them, but they are rollicking good fun.
What we're going to do now is we're going to rank them.
Wow. Okay.
So actually, being fourth is not a badge of dishonor. It's just you know, somebody's got to come. So
that's yes. Yeah, I just want to emphasise that because and what you don't know yet, Paul, is that this is not another episode of Underground Nights. It is, but it's part of the Underground Nights franchise of our new series. On the Fitzroy Rivers, because what we're going to start doing now, and if anyone is still listening, stay tuned, because each and every episode we are going to interview one or two different actors or producers or people behind these movies, because this is the beginning of Underground Essex, the franchise. Anyway, so you go first.
So at number four, I've got number two, Rise of Fitzroy 2.
Unfortunately. And again, we've, and this is what I wanted to say as a disclaimer to anyone listening, especially because we're going to be asking people involved in these films to come on this podcast. We've just talked for an hour and a half about how much we love all four movies.
Oh, yeah. So this is, there's no shame here.
No.
It's just a bit of fun.
And also, what we're also going with is we're also talking about favourites, i.e. what do we want to watch over and over again?
Correct.
Right. And I'm with you. Two is, unfortunately, is the grittiest. It's one of the best made. The performances, it probably has probably the best acting. However, it's the one I watch the least. So yeah. Unfortunately, it has to be fourth.
Well, this is going to shock you because next, at three, is number three.
Whoa! That's shocked me. Tell me more.
It is a lot of fun, right? Mm. Don't take that away from me.
No,
but I just think the others have a little bit more. I enjoyed them more as a spectacle.
Okay, I'm going to be interested to hear why. One, because I mean, again, one falls into the similar.
Tell me what's your number three?
I'm tossing them up right now.
But nobody wants you tossing on the internet.
Unfortunately, and I think it might be. I think my three is going to be your one. I think. Oh fuck! this is too hard. Oh my god.
Shows how serious we're taking this, by the way.
I know. To be honest, I think my third has to be a joint second.
No. You've got to do one to four. Come on.
Okay. It's got to be four.
Oh, okay.
Reluctantly. And again, four I will watch 1,000 more times than I watch one. But the thing with one is... it is, and again, I'm breaking my rule here about the fun thing, but it's obvious which one's my number one. There's no way I can put the two Ricky Hartnett ones at the bottom because his performance is magnificent. The Tube Train thing. So the fourth one,
it's... I said number three. That's fine. You have to spell yourself any more, James. You've already talked about it.
But basically, I think my problem is the fourth one has lots of genius things about it, but it wasn't as good as the third one.
Well, my number two is number one, the original.
And I'm with you there. Oh, no, yes, I'm with you there.
Okay, so my number one is number four.
Right.
And my just number... Just because I laugh so much and absolutely... I wasn't expecting a comedy.
Yeah.
And to be delivered one that made... Mate, I'm not going to... It's hard to get me to properly howl with laughter.
Same.
Really hard.
Yeah.
You know, I'm 50 now. I've seen everything. I'm done. Yeah. Yeah. You really got to fucking get it right out to get me laughing, and that absolutely killed me. So that's why it's my number one.
And you're spot on. I mean, I've already banged on enough as to why this is my number one. I'm still questioning my choice of two being, because you're absolutely right about four being hilarious. However, that hilarity in four cannot exist without this. Four is Godfather 2, and this is Godfather 1 in that you just can't have it. But the problem is that the first one is such a brilliant piece of filmmaking, at least for the beginning. Again, I would definitely remove the Turkish thing. But anyway, I have to put the first one at two because I don't want to be seen to be separating the different actors and the different people involved. But the thing I would say is that it still blows my mind how different they all are.
Yep. So we've got our little quiz now, James, where I've laboriously gone through every film and did a little tick every time they said the word.
The C word, yes.
Right. So what I'm going to do, we'll do a little higher-lower quiz. So, but you can have a guess, if you like. Rise of the Foot Soldier 1, how many times do they say the word cunt?
See, I don't think it's as... prevalence because it's very noticeable in the later movies, like the third one, because lines like you know when a stone cold fucking cokehead turns down a big fat line of blow, you don't have to be Miss Cunting fucking Marple to know something's afoot, right? I mean, what an amazing line, right?
Yep.
And the first one, I would say 70 times.
Holy shit! And you've no idea about this. It's 71.
No way.
Yep.
That is a sign of how many times.
Oh my god! Catherine's in the room here. She just looked over at me. She's like absolutely gobsmacked.
Really, should we be gobsmacked?
This is the kind of quizzing I love. So, Rise of the Foot Soldier 2, more or less cunts?
Oh. less.
Less. Go on. Do you want to have a guess at the number? I'm going to tell you are correct.
Okay, I'd say 58.
45.
Wow.
So you got 2 out of 2 so far, James.
This is unbelievable.
Moving on to number three.
Yes.
Is number three higher or lower, cunts, than number two? So number two had 45.
Way higher.
It is way higher. Do you want to have a guess? Way higher.
Can I ask one question before I guess? I'm assuming, well, actually, I won't ask because I'm going to assume. I'm assuming it's more than the first one as well.
It is, yes.
So I'm going to go with 94 C words.
Oh, fuck off. It's 95. No, 92.
No!
92. Yes! No! Really good. Fuck, did you know that?
I honestly have no idea. This is insane. Oh, my
Can
God.
Can you see my notepad?
This is the clip that we're going to open the podcast with. You know, unbelievable.
Right. James, number four.
Yeah.
Higher or lower? It's this. We should have called this, you know, Mr. Trick. We should have said, called this Play Your Cunts Right.
I mean, it would have to be.
Ooh.
No, you know what? I think it's obviously going to be around the same as the third. It's not going to be much different. It's going to be 10 either way, I think, within 10 either way. And I'm going to say...
Oh, you could cut the tension with a knife.
I know. I mean, like, my instinct tells me it's less, right? But I cannot believe that they would make another one. And actually, what's the running time of this?
Oh.
Okay, I think it's less. I think it's possibly... Slightly less C-words in the fourth one.
It is less. Do you want to have a guess at how many it was?
Okay, I'm going to go with... it's probably closer to 80.
75. But, mate, you were within 5, 2 and 1 of the number of C-words across a whole franchise with no prior knowledge and just guessing. That's incredible.
It's amazing. And it's not even like when I'm watching them, if that is not proof that I've watched these movies hundreds of times, there it is.
Well, now you've got a nice little... Next time someone calls you a cunt, we've got a nice little anecdote.
Yeah.
Actually, mate, I'm an expert.
Now, listen, I've got to mention one important thing. In case anyone was in any question after all that to my obsession with these movies... I am but
a mere amateur in your presence, James.
Well, no, I mean, I had once spent a wonderful afternoon, and hopefully we're going to get him on the podcast. I spent a day in Birmingham with Bernard O'Mahony, and he signed my Essex Boy book, and it's absolutely genius. It says, James, please meet me in Workhouse Lane tonight. We need to talk. Love you, Bernie.
That's genius.
And then I also had the pleasure of having coffee one time with Tony Thompson, who actually interviewed Darren Nichols, The Grass, or Liar, depending on who you...
Nobody likes The Grass.
And it says here, to James, the truth is out there. And we haven't even touched upon the fact that Jack Wombs and Mick Steele...
they got banged up for it.
Right. But the fact that... So Noy is now out, walking around. So is the head of the Adams Family, Geezer. He's out. And either Wombs or Steele are about to get released. And there will be people who tell you that they definitely didn't do it.
Catherine thinks... The old Bill might have done it in retaliation for Leah Betts because her dad, Paul Betts, old Bill.
Yes, funny enough,
and he looks like old Bill as well. When you saw an interview with him today,
he does. He's I thought the exact same thing, and actually I thought it at the time, and people said it, and I thought, well, it's not really fair on the police to say that. But then I'm rewatching one of these 15 movies, Bonded by Blood, watching that and seeing the way that they were and how they were basically untouchable. I don't think it's beyond the realm of possibility. It's funny how Jack Wombs and Mick Steele pop up in all the different movies. And of course, he's played by Billy Murray in lots of them. And again, the actors change. But most people agree that a couple of pot importers did not shotgun three geezers.
No.
Anyway, this will be talked about a lot more on the 500-part Essex Boys
Essex
Underground
Boys
Night
special.
Catherine, take one good look at Paul Field, because this might be the last time you see him, because we are going to dig deep into the research on, because someone out there knows who done it.
And, they did.
And I must say, all Tony Thompson books about the British crime scene are magnificent. This is a man that once took crack with a prostitute in the name of journalism for The Guardian. And it's a fantastic, and it's a brilliant book. It's called Gangs, right? And you're reading it, and it's all a very intelligent, insightful thing into the inner workings of the criminal mind and the street dealer up to the kingpin. It's kind of like The Wire, but set in Camden. And then he has a scene when he goes and talks to this prostitute, and he's interviewing her about crack. And she says, do you want to try it? And he thinks, I've been writing about crack for 25 years, I should try it. So he has a hit on the pipe, and suddenly in the book it goes, whoa, fuck, yeah, it's all written like that, right? And he's like, yeah, and it's all like this. And then he says, best feeling ever, and then she says, do you want another one? And he goes, yeah, and then he goes, actually, that's how it starts, and he never did it again.
Should we save the rest of it for another time? Because we've definitely, got like definitely. Gangs of London, Top Boy, yes. Villain. Let's park that.
Well, if there's one thing I've realised, Paul, and we can leave this in, other people can hear this, right? I mean, I've missed you massively. And one of the important things about this pandemic and global lockdown is it's made us realise what's important to us in life. And what's important to me is three dead drug dealers. No, what's important to me is you and this. And what am I passionate about? What do I want to be talking about? And believe it or not, listeners, all billions of you out there, it's hard for Paul and I to find other people that want to talk about this shit with us. So you're right. Let's make it a part series. I actually haven't finished Gangs of London. It turns out that contrary to the first episode seeming magnificent, I think you're right about where it's headed. But this is part one of a new... Mega Crim special.
That's Mega Crim, not Mega Quim.
Oh, you know what? You know, here in Canada, you know a quiff? This tuft of hair.
Yeah. Right?
In Canada, the quiff is a lady's front a vagina, right?
Right.
Right. It's absolutely true. So no one told me this. So all along, so first of all, I discover it. My wife and I are at the hairdressers, and our hairdresser says, what should I give her? And I said, why don't you give her a nice quiff? And he goes, yeah. and he ingeniously, this is absolutely true, he ingeniously says, doesn't she have one already? Right? Which I thought was beautiful. And then I realised, right, that I live in a town called Quizpamsis, right? And whenever I'd go on the road and joke about this stupid town name, Quizpamsis, people would say, oh, do you know what we call Quizpamsis? We call it Kiss Pam's Quiff. Kiss Pam's Quiff. I used to think, what's funny about
kissing
that
someone's quiff, yeah.
And then I found out, and I'm like, oh, and then what makes it funnier is, of course, my name's wife is fucking Pam, and yes, I have.
Yes.
There we are. Oh, right. That was
Live
beautiful,
a dream, brother. Join us time for more adventures in criminality on Underground Nights.
Love you, brother. I'm off to watch Foot Soldier 1, 2, 3 and 4. Thank you.
We didn't even mention Terry Stone Syrup. I remember he tweeted me once because I tried to nominate his wig for a BAFTA.
Oh, did you? That's genius.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.